Welcome to Access Advocacy on thepowerofvoices.com. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. The goals of Access Advocacy are to improve the lives of patients and caregivers who are dealing with the chronic illness of sickle cell disease. Today, we're speaking with Tanya Price of the Houston Sickle Cell Organization. I had the good fortune of meeting her at the Sickle Cell Consortium meeting in Atlanta. Hi, Tanya.
Hello. How are you?
Doing great. Better now that I'm talking to you.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, tell us a little bit about your organization.
So, the Sickle Cell Association of Houston, we serve as community-based and care coordination center here and referral force here in the city of Houston for the greater metropolitan area. And most of our services are aimed at helping individuals achieve better outcomes. So we do more, have a more hands-on approach with families who are affected by sickle cell disease. We are proud of the staff that we have, our consultants who work with us in areas of sickle cell, some of Houston's finest in the areas of sickle cell. So we are an end-all, be-all, one-stop shop for individuals living with sickle cell disease.
Wow, sounds wonderful. I mean, and as the mother of a child with sickle cell, something that really, really is needed.
Yes.
So how long have you guys been, and I guess, when were you guys formed? I mean, how long does it take to get to the point where you're actually able to provide services?
So here in Houston, things moved relatively fast for us. As a family, we'd moved away from Houston for about 8 years, we moved not very far away. We lived in Dallas, Texas for some time, and we moved back here to Houston in 2014. And the reason or how Sickle Cell Association of Houston was sort of birthed was as a result of encounter that my daughter who lives with sickle cell had in the emergency room department. And so she goes to the emergency room, of course, in crisis. And just the culture that she, or the challenge that she encountered while explaining to medical professionals what was going on with her body, explaining to medical professionals what sickle cell disease was. And I think her frustration lied more so in leaving with feelings that she was there seeking pain medication, and that was not so. And so I was proud of her in those moments where she chose to really be her own self-advocate and really standing up for herself and not necessarily being so intimidated by a white coat. She, you know, was very vocal about her disease, and she knew that something was wrong with her, going on with in her body. And I was happy that she forced the hand to get the necessary test that she needed to have. And had she not done that, we may not have her here with us today. So it was one of those encounters. We had maybe about three or four. And she comes home and she says, "Mom, you know, we need to do something. You know, this is just not right. And you've always talked to us about being the change that we want to see. So why can't we be?" And that is what sort of started the birthing process of Sickle Cell Association of Houston.
Oh, my God. You gave me chills. Wow.
Yes, that is what started it all. And so one of the things that we wanted to do was we wanted to make sure that we are an organization that not necessarily filled with a lot of fluff stuff. You know, education, outreach, that's definitely needed. But we wanted to make sure that we are touching the lives and the families of those impacted by sickle cell, and not just the person who's living with the disease, because it affects the entire family unit. So we focus a lot on care coordination and then a true resource. So we definitely go beyond the referral. Many families, they laugh at us because, you know, we have this saying here that we say, once you meet us, you're stuck with us now for life. And So we do everything from meeting our patients at discharge or before discharge from a hospitalization to ensuring that they have the appropriate services and support in place by the time they get home. So we make sure they have that follow-up appointment in place to follow up with their primary care physician. If we've identified that they don't have a medical care team in place, we put that team in place for them. We like our families to think that we are that concierge service that you get at a hotel or, you know, a fancy restaurant or anything. So we are that for sickle cell, for our sickle cell family. So we like to tell everyone to think of us as having a VIP experience for sickle cell.
I think I'm moving to Houston. All right, so let's just walk through this bit of it. So I am one of your patients. You call them patients or family members or clients, or I'm a member.
Yeah, clients, patients. I try to stay away from. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a member of the Houston Sickle Cell family. And I'm what we call in LA an orphan. So the orphans to me are the people who are the adults who have moved to California or live here, and the family's kind of done. They've got what I call chronic disease fatigue, and you know, they no longer show up, that kind of thing. And so the person's alone, and so they call us and we meet them at the hospital and do things. But now I'm in Houston and I'm a member of your wonderful community. So I'm going to the hospital. Do I call you and say I'm going? Does the hospital call you and say someone's come in? How does that work?
Yes. So here in Houston, we have wonderful relationships with our medical community and wonderful partnerships. And we are notified of the individuals who are there with sickle cell. And so we go in and meet the family or the individual personally. And we just sort of have a one-on-one discussion. It's very personable. It's very intimate discussions about what they're feeling, what have been their perceptions and what they're going through with living with sickle cell and how we can make it better. Sometimes we are able to, and for the most part, we're able to get a great deal out of individuals living with sickle cell that many clinicians, social workers, and case managers cannot get out of a patient with sickle cell who's in the hospital. Because a lot of times, many sickle cell patients feel like, you know, they're just doing their job. They don't really understand what I'm going through. And so when they meet us, they see themselves in us because we are living what they're going through from a perspective as a mother, from a perspective as a child or daughter who lives with sickle cell. It's sort of like we get each other. We speak the same language. And so that's why how we are so well received. And we find that in our approach with the patients, they become more compliant with their medical care. They begin a process of feeling more empowered when they see that, oh, I'm not the only one that goes through this. Or in some situations and circumstances, they'll see, oh, my situation is not as bad as this person's with sickle cell. So it's all about how you are looking at your chronic condition. Mm-hmm. And if you are defining yourself by that. And that's one of the things that we talk a lot about, is not defining yourself by your diagnosis. You're so much bigger than your diagnosis. And so just to make sure that they have that support and that they know that we are there for them 110%, it makes all the difference in the world to a person who's living with sickle cell disease, especially if they feel that they are a burden to their family or that they are putting the family at a strain. It's good for them to know that they have Sickle Cell Association of Houston, or Miss Tanya, as they say, by their side. It makes a lot of difference. in the world.
What are the age range? Are you just like young adults and, you know, young to older adults? Are you also working with families?
Yes. We see anyone living with sickle cell. It doesn't matter the age, because it's very important that both the individual and the families living with sickle cell understand sickle cell in and out. We have programming geared at assisting in that transition piece where there's a lot of drop-off at. So we even do things like role play with our 14, 15, 16-year-olds, those young adults or young folks who are graduating high school because they're getting ready to go to college. How to complete your new patient application, medical application, when you are transitioning to your adult hematologist or, you know, from pediatrics to adulthood. And we do those things so that, number one, it reduces the anxieties that that person may be having, and it eases the parents' minds as well. And so we are huge advocates of role-playing, helping them understand things that are basic to us as adults, as what my ID card is, what a group number means, what that RX number on that ID card means, what's a subscriber number. So we go through all of these things in our teachings to make sure that we can kind of reduce some of this lack or to help fill the gap where we identify some of the fallout in transition.
Wow. So,
yes, ma'am.
With your transition, so you're actually working with the young person. Do you have something in place to help the parent in that process? I'm speaking as a parent. This is kind of hard for me to.
Yes.
You know as another mother.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying.
So how are you?
Yeah. So we have parents all the time, and I will admit to this, I'm very hard on parents of our young men because they want to do everything for our boys. And
exactly. Yeah.
And we work directly with the parents as well, and helping them see things from a mother's eyes, because I dealt with some of those same concerns and some of the same fears and just having some of those questions. Do they know how to do this? Do they know what medications they are on? Do they know the milligram? Do they know understand the dosage? Do they really understand what's being prescribed to them? If they are away at college and they go to the emergency room and that emergency room physician prescribes an antibiotic or another medication, do they know to check back with their primary care physicians or their hematologists to make sure those medications, you know, will act well with each other? You know, do they have on file their information regarding their condition with the wellness center on campus so that if they miss, those days are covered to make up? So we work with the parents in those ways. We work with parents who have children who may age off of their insurance plans, with helping them trying to locate additional insurance to keep the kiddos covered, young adults covered, until they have landed a career in insurance of their own.
Yeah.
Wow. So we definitely work with the families, and we do have a support group that over the holidays is pretty. It's a little tough to get everyone together. So January, we have a support group. I believe it's the second Tuesday of every month in January. And then we have some things that we're currently working on just for parents. We are trying to put together or thinking of putting together a parental retreat for sickle cell.
Brilliant.
Coming this summer. Yes. So we want to make sure we have all bases covered for that one individual living with sickle cell, and it's a job. It's definitely a job.
Yeah, I love that idea. So yeah, tell you what, you guys will work on one for Houston, and I'll work on one for here in LA, and let's see if we
wonderful.
Can. And let's see if we can like get it like line them up, right? So I don't know.
Yes.
We can be sister cities.
Yes,
but
yes,
that,
absolutely.
That idea of getting getting something together for the parents. Here, I'm putting it in my book.
That would be amazing.
Just a parent retreat. And for how long do you guys, you know, for a day or two, or can they get away overnight? How do you gauge that?
Well, this is something that's in the works. This is in the works. And we're thinking a two-dayer.
Okay.
Just
okay.
2 days to breathe. Mm-hmm, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I also see that on your website, and you know, for our listeners, you have a really cool website, and they can get to it by going to www.sicklecellhouston.org. Check out some of the things that you guys are doing.
Yes, we are excited about the work here in Houston and with sickle cell. You'd just be surprised that when we are out speaking, the new, I guess, sort of glimmer of hope that we get, those who want to begin the process of pouring into sickle cell, and they feel really bad about, you know, sometimes they feel bad about feeling like they don't know enough when they thought they knew enough about sickle cell. And after they've heard us speak, they always tell us that they had no idea that these were the things that individuals living with sickle cell were facing. Everyone is pretty much aware of the crisis, the pain crises, but no one is aware of the medical manifestations associated with sickle cell disease. And it's tough. It's tough.
That's been our findings too. And I always say this to people, it's across the board, right? It could be healthcare providers to somebody I might be talking to at a church, and their perception of sickle cell is so simplistic. You know, they really have no idea of the pathology of the disease. And when you start to speak to them, it's like you said, they feel really bad and want to be educated. So how are you doing this? Are you scheduling talks, or how is that working?
So here we receive many requests, and we have biannual in-services with our school-based nurses in different districts. We have we call them in services. We have educational in services in our hospitals. We go to churches. We participate in a ton of health fairs across the city. I believe last year we did about 78 health fairs last year, raising awareness for sickle cell. Currently, we're the only partner agency for sickle cell with the city of Houston, because we took these concerns to our health department and really gave them a level of insight that they had not had before. So we decided to bring together other like organizations and community-based organizations and support groups in one space to form the Houston Sickle Cell Collaborative, or the Houston Sickle Cell Task Force. So we are currently in the works with that. We've been meeting for about a year, and I'm working on goals that we can work on and put out there collectively as a collective unit. We have Texas State Rep Jarvis Johnson will begin serving as chairman of the board for Sickle Cell Association of Houston beginning in 2018. So we're very excited about that, and putting, you know, together legislation to help fund things related to both sickle cell disease and sickle cell trait, which a lot of people don't talk very much about. And so we have been on the move in such small amount of time.
Wow.
And we're just about the business of sickle cell and making sure the sickle cell community is receiving the appropriate level of care and quality care that they should be receiving here in the city of Houston, you know, one of the largest cities in the country. And to know that there aren't adequate services and supports in place for individuals living with sickle cell to me was just mind-blowing when I moved back here 4 years ago.
I am so impressed. We're going to take a break now.
Thank you.
This is Access Advocacy, and we're speaking with Tanya Price of the Houston Sickle Cell Organization. We'll continue our conversation in a bit on thepowerofvoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Adrienne Shapiro on Access Advocacy via thepowerofvoices.com, speaking with Tanya Prince about living with sickle cell in the city of Houston, which has her amazing organization. So here's a question for you.
Yes.
I want to know how you got to go into the hospitals, because that's one of the things we face. I mean, we have a couple of friendly hospitals who let us come in, but how did you go about creating that relationship between your organization and hospitals so that they were trusting you enough to let you know when someone comes in?
Yes. So I believe the hospital systems are beginning to recognize the importance of the community-based organization. And oftentimes, community-based organizations are for the people, really, in all honesty. Community-based organizations are for the people. And what better way to understand the people than to connect with your community-based organization? So these health systems reached out to us, and we started with a few, just piloting some things and testing some things out. And then they realized that some patients that they were seeing often, suddenly when we became involved, they weren't seeing them as much. Because one of the things that hospitals, they have their case managers and social workers and their patient navigators who do, you know, their role, but they can only do so much when they have a caseload. So here's what we say. We are your best friend. We are their best friend. And so if they can have some help with the sickle cell population, which could take up a lot of their time of trying to locate resources and services and things like that, but if I can partner with a sickle cell organization who can help me in this, then why not work together? And so that is pretty much the relationship that we have with them. We're the hospital's best friend. And I think more hospitals, if they're smart, they would partner with more disease-specific organizations who have a proven model. One of the things that we do here at Sickle Cell Houston is that not only do we pull together a medical care team for our patients, but we speak a lot about the mental health component that a lot of people don't talk about. So we integrate that as part of the medical care plan. Now, whether that client or patient wants to receive that type of service, it's totally up to them. But we like people to understand what that is and what that looks like, because I know that many people that we talk to, in their mind, it's about going to someone's office and laying on a couch and talking about your problem. And so we have discussions around that. What does that look like to you? And we work with wonderful mental health providers who specialize in medical trauma. And if I may be honest, and it's someone who looks like majority of our sickle cell population,
like
African Americans. So they're more open. Mm-hmm. So we began to open this line of communication and explore this avenue that we never even considered before. And so when you pull all these pieces together, you empower that patient. When you empower a patient and you educate that patient, the less likely they are to overutilize an emergency room, because now they're into relationship building, because that's what we're teaching, relationship building. Have that relationship with that physician who know you in and out.
Empowerment and education.
They know you in and out. You're not going to even want to deal with the hassle of going to an emergency room.
Right.
I can give you a good example. One day, my daughter and I were on our way to a meeting, and she wasn't feeling well. And she said, "Mom, I don't feel well." So we were thinking, okay, she skipped breakfast. So we pulled over, got her some breakfast, and in about 10 minutes, we make it to the meeting. So 15 minutes into the meeting, she says, "Mom, I can't see." And so I'm looking at her, and I'm saying, "What do you mean you can't see?" And she said, "I can't see."
Oh,
and I said, "You don't." And so I'm having this dialogue. You can't see, like, can't see, or you can't see, like, blurry, can't see. So she's like, "I can't see you."
Oh, my goodness.
So we're in this meeting having this dialogue. And so we leave out of the meeting, and we go into the hallway. And so she contacted her primary care office, and, of course, it was sort of like, you know, a callback was needed. So then she contacted a hematologist. She gets a hematologist on the phone. Hematologist tells her, "Well, you know, go to the emergency room." So she says, "Oh, my God, he wants me to go to the emergency room. I am not going to the emergency room about with my eyes." So we then say, "Okay, you don't want to do that. So let's call your ophthalmologist." So we contact the ophthalmologist. And here's what I want people to know and understand. And I don't know how it is in each individual state, but here in the state of Texas, the physician offices can do an immediate, urgent, and an emergent appointment. So we call her ophthalmologist and we request an emergent appointment. Emergent appointments, they can get you in same day. We got her in. They know what's going on with her. They immediately get her in. And within less than an hour, maybe, total time from driving there in the office, she was out. Her ophthalmologist, because she has a relationship, he understands her sickle cell disease, he immediately knew what had happened with her and her eyes. Immediately, because of those relationships. And so she had the procedure done. She had to have an injection. What was happening was that she was sickling behind the eye, and one of the vessels burst and was causing some bleeding over the eye, and that's why she could not see. And so I like to share that story often when we are talking with patients about the importance and the power of having those relationships mm-hmm. with your physician, because those relationships take you a long way, and it saves you a great deal of frustration and anxiety and fear and all those things. And, you know, feeding ourselves this narrative of, "Oh, my God, what if I go blind and I'm permanently blind?" You know, mm-hmm. those things. And so that's the power of having relationships and building relationships, and that's what we teach.
Well, and even given that in this story, what if she had gone to the emergency room? What, and I don't know, I mean, our emergency rooms are mostly trauma centers here in LA now. And so even the best of hospitals, that wait in the emergency room can be anywhere from 3 to 24 hours. So, you know, being able to resolve this, understand it, get a diagnosis, get to treatment in the mm-hmm. short in the hour versus anywhere from 3 to 24 hours, I imagine affects the outcome of when you finally get the treatment, because you've been in that.
It could indeed. It could have we could have had a totally different outcome, but thankful that are educated enough to know what to do and when to do it, and to know how to navigate our system very well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I have this conversation a lot with our community, because when they say to me, "My doctor," generally they're speaking about their hematologist. Now, as the mom, I was guilty of that. And that was coming up, you know, once she gets the diagnosis, Marissa got the diagnosis. No matter what it was, I ran everything through the hematologist first. So rather than her pediatrician being her doctor, in quotes, her hematologist was her doctor, and then the pediatrician and the ophthalmologist, you know, they all fell after him. And by the time they get to be adults, it's kind of the same thing, although I'm trying to get them to look at their model differently, and, you know, not go to their hematologist for everything. I keep going, you need a primary care physician. If you're a woman, you need a gynecologist. You have to have a dentist. You have to have an ophthalmologist because you want to understand what's going on. In some degrees, have a relationship with a pain specialist that's not your hematologist. Even though your hematologist, you need a mental health professional. And it's so hard getting them to understand. So what I say is, look, you have somebody that you can sit and talk to all about yourself for 45 minutes, and you don't even have to worry about what they think about you because that's their job. You know, you just get to go and just talk to get them away from the idea that going there and speaking means that you're crazy or you're further damaged. It's bad enough to have sickle cell, and now you're telling, you know, me that I'm mentally ill too by saying I need to have this therapist. And I try to talk to mothers of young children and say, you have to look at total care and even getting the kids small into the habit of speaking with a mental health person, as well as you yourself as the parent, because there's all that stuff we carry. I mean, every mother's guilty for us to have that
outlet.
Right, right. In our toolkit, too, for ourselves, where I can just go in and say, oh, I hate this. I'm so pissed off, you know, and get it out.
Yeah. So that's right. What's happened with me, and I share my story as well, because I didn't realize until it was 1 year, my boss was like, Tanya, do not come back here. I want you to go and talk to someone. And I was like, oh, I'm fine. And he says, yes, I know. And it took someone from the outside to say that although I had this personality and not much seemed different, but I think someone on the outside recognized that I was doing so much. And as mothers and parents, we are always in survival mode. We're always in survival mode. 24/7. And so I had to learn how to adjust. But in learning that, I had to have someone help me navigate through those things. And that's why I try to tell people all the time that I strongly encourage having therapy sessions. It's so good for your soul. It's so good for your soul.
It is a challenge. I think we are having to I have these discussions with the community on wellness. So in our wellness model, I have your physical. So I have the exercise, the yoga. I talk about diet, what good foods. I talk about healthcare, making sure that you have, as you've talked to, a whole I call it you need a team. So you have a team of docs, right, so that you can I talk about your spiritual base, whatever that is. That's very important, your spiritual and your community base. And then I also talk about your financial wellness. Now, people get, well, at first were like looking at me like, you know, you're talking about my wellness, you know, why are you talking about money? And I always say, if your money house isn't straight, none of your other houses are going to be straight, and what that looks like, especially if you're dealing with a chronic illness. And so many of our community members, especially the older adults, and by that I mean 30, a lot of times the disease has caught up with them, and they're becoming more and more disabled and having to go from a job kind of situation to where they're actually on disability and trying to figure out how are they going to manage a life on that. And I talk to them a lot about looking at what people think negatively of entitlements. Well, those entitlements are there based upon tax base, which means that while you were working, while your parents were working, while your sisters and brothers were working, and your neighbors are working, that money is going into a pot to help people for use by people who can no longer continue to put money into that pod. And I always say it has to start with a diagnosis. You have to have a diagnosis. I always say it's not, a diagnosis is not a label, but I think of it as a financial tool. Because once I have that diagnosis, then I know what it is I can be helped with, right? So if I can get, for example, my dad said, you had this kid, you're going to take care of this kid. So I worked, went to school, worked, and I kept two insurance policies going. So, because she would max one out, so the and then the other one didn't start for 6 months, right? And so I had to have two going, and then and that was insane. That was insane. Yeah. I mean, if I had put all that money into retirement, I could finance Access Advocacy now, right? But when I got to the point where I could no longer insure her. Right? They said, you can't insure. We had to then go to Social Security. And I had to fight in Social Security for 3 years for her to get her Social Security benefits. 3 years and a lawyer. Because she was already an adult. And they kept saying to me, why didn't you do this when she was a child? It would have been so much easier. It was crazy. So I talked to parents really about getting a diagnosis, setting up that team like you're talking about, getting that help with through the schools, if it's there for individualized learning program. The importance of getting that done young so that when you're college age and all that, you move with those entitlements with you into the university setting. And that's key, because of course our children are so beautiful and they don't look sick. How many times have we heard that, right?
Right.
But if we have all those things, you have all those things in place, the younger, the better. And so the things that you guys are doing, I mean, we really need want those things here in California. It's kind of mind-blowing that we don't. People always think we do, but we don't. I mean, we're starting, you know, we had the registry and we got a bunch of community health workers who were helping to get people information registered, and they were doing some outreach and things like that. But as far as having our CBOs in place and having the relationships that you've described, we're just now on the ground floor, starting those.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, awesome.
Yeah,
awesome that it's finally started to catch fire.
Exactly. I didn't know what kind of silo I was living in before I started this. I mean, I had my daughter, and then I had another daughter, and we thought her cord blood. We'd use her cord blood, and then Marissa, of course, would would be okay. But she had so many antibodies, and because they're half sisters, they didn't have enough markers. So when they came out after doing the analysis, they said she would only have a 5% chance of surviving the procedure. So we sort of, you know, backed off. And I was kind of back in my silo of working and taking care of Marissa and getting Casey through high school and into college. And so basically what I was doing is I would go and support our local foundation through some fundraising for camp. You know, I know they did it. They do a great camp. And so I was doing fundraising for camp. But there weren't places and there weren't things in place for the adults or for the families. Sort of in my silo, I thought my daughter was getting great care. I mean, we fight like everybody else have to. It depends on which doc you get in the ER, which nurses. I mean, we've had actual nurses draw, you know, team risks, not team risks, because they didn't want to give her the pain meds, you know. So we were just navigating this, but through really amazing hospitals, and she had a really good doc. And then once I started Access Advocacy, when my husband gave me the 5 years to do that. And I started doing actual point of care advocacy with what I call the orphans. And I started getting to some of these smaller, community hospitals and even some of the bigger ones and seeing how people were being treated. I started looking for resources like yours to get people help and found that there weren't any. And said, okay, so that's why it really speaks to my heart what you do. I call it the point of service advocacy, which I think is the most important because that to me is the only place where we can really keep people alive. I mean, I've lost...
That's right.
The people that I've lost that I've been advocating for, I've lost because they've had sepsis. I've lost because they were released from the hospital late at night. You know what I mean? And they go home and there's nobody there to look after them. Because some of them just get so depressed and they just are so tired that doing the things they need to do to take care of themselves, they just can't do it. I've had...
they can't do it.
Children basically taken away from them because they're tired and the other parent is terrified that, you know, they're going to die and they're trying to protect their child from their, basically it's more the moms, right? And such injustices done because of this disease and the lack of knowledge around it and the lack of services and protection. So I truly, truly commend you for what you're doing. And
thank you so much.
I think you need to present your model at the next PIC conference. And
I will bring it up.
All right. So we're going to take another break. And then while we're away, I want you to really think about what it is you'd like to tell our listeners about what you're doing and what you think and what you'd like to see. So we're going to take a break now. Welcome back. I'm Adrienne Shapiro on Access Advocacy via thepowerofvoices.com, speaking with Tanya Prince about living with sickle cell in the city of Houston, which has her amazing organization. Thank you, Tanya, for joining us today on Access Advocacy.
Thank you for having us.
This conversation has really charged me. And so I think not only am I envious of your baseball team, I'm envious of your program.
No.
Yes, yes. But we do have one other question, and then I'm going to just let you talk to us. With all that's happened with the storm and everything in Houston, and we hear about your community in particular pulling together and helping each other. Can you share a little bit about that, since you were there, boots on the ground? Can you just share with us?
That was very, very tough. Like I said, I was a Houston native and never seen anything like that before. And the number of people and homes and lives that were affected by Hurricane Harvey. It was great to see how strong Houston is. It was great to see for one moment that it didn't matter your race or your gender or any of those things or what political affiliation you were a part of. It was good to see the humanness come back into play. And it was very tough. Many of our sickle cell families have suffered. We are still working with families to date who are continuing to need resources, housing, and things like that. The one thing that I love the most about such a tough time here in the sickle cell community is that we definitely pulled through for one another. We had Dr. Lakia Bailey's organization, the Sickle Cell Community Consortium, reach out to us with the work of Mary Mia Robinson, and they held a pulling in donations for Houston. So we had trucks come in from Atlanta for Hurricane Harvey folks. We had someone from the BJ's restaurants and brewery employees hosted a Hurricane Harvey drive, Rancho Cucamonga. They drove here in partnership as well as with University of Phoenix. They drove here and donated many, many items. I mean, it was such a beautiful thing to see everyone be able to pull together for the sickle cell community during that time. And it was pretty devastating. And, you know, many people don't remember, but just 2 years prior to Hurricane Harvey, lots of people were still trying to recover from that storm.
Right, right.
So it's a lot of rebuilding that has to be done here in Houston. It was pretty bad.
Well, I'm just so happy to hear how the community pulled together and helped each other.
Yes.
I want more of that help pulling together and helping of each other in non-crisis times.
Yes. Exactly. You took the words right out of my mouth. I would love to see, and this is just a vision of mine, I would love to see every single community-based organization, support group, no matter how small you think you are, because you never know. Many people don't continue to walk in the purpose because they think that they're not making an impact. And most times, you really are. But I would love to see every single sickle cell, hospital, clinic, community-based organization come together as one huge collaborative, sharing models, sharing best practices, so that your community that you are here to serve can see the immeasurable amount of support that they have. So I want to challenge the leaders in the sickle cell community to find a way to collaborate on a larger scale and to stop working on an island or in silos, because your niche or what you do very well at can help someone who may not have that piece of the puzzle somewhere else. And bringing all those things together, together and collectively, we can heal our sickle cell population through education and empowerment and support.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for your inspiring talk and sharing with us. And I have a list of things we're going to be doing. I think we should do together. And I think then what we should try to do is when we have one of these opportunities where we're all together is we should say, come, and if you have something that's working, bring your template for that. I mean, I love
that's right.
Gary from, is Gary Indiana, I think. Oh, God.
Indiana. Yes. Mr. Gibson.
Oh,
yes.
My God. Well, he gave us a talk on
such an inspiration.
Oh, and how he did his town hall, and he just, boom, there were the slides, and I thought, oh, I'm taking pictures of these slides. I'm going to go home. We're doing it. You know, we are doing it now. We're planning on doing it. We'll be doing it in January. So,
amen. Good deal.
And yeah, so I've like notes here from you on this. You're absolutely right. If we don't have to have the energy to push it from scratch, we can take what works and start at that point. A known thing. It's like,
that's right.
I call it the Disney model. So what Disney does, it'll write a song, right? It'll write a song, and it will have 10 different versions of that song by different artists, and it'll use it in every kind of way, right? Because that song works, right? Same thing with software.
Right.
Software is somebody writes a script and it does whatever it's supposed to. It lets you fill in your name and your email, and it puts you automatically in a list, right? That everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. Everybody uses it. And they just have to do it once, and now everybody out there can use it. And I think we need to get, mm-hmm. we can get there so that our energy isn't spent creating that which is already created.
That's right.
Or proving that which
that
we already know.
That is already created. That is correct. That is correct. And so. I want to say this as well, too, is that I want to start seeing the sickle cell community population. I want to start seeing them show up and show out.
Right. Right.
It's time to show up and show out for who you are. Make sure that you are that you are represented. Make sure they see you and they know that you're here. And we want change for the better. And so that's my challenge to the sickle cell community. And we're also actually having a walk.
Huh.
We're raising awareness. Our dates got pushed back from Sickle Cell Awareness Month because of Hurricane Harvey. But the show is still going on next Saturday at McGregor Park at 8 a.m. for Sickle Cell Awareness. We're going to keep that torch fired up.
Well,
we're going to keep it fired up.
I have to say, you got a fire. You got a bonfire. And you've passed that torch on to me. And I want to.
Yes, well. And that's all that it takes. That is all it takes.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so very much. And thank you
You're
for
welcome.
The work you do. And
thank you.
You know, and you and your baby girl. Tell her I said
yes.
Thank you to my kids say that, so when I'm introducing them, they go, Marissa says, well, I'm the reason, and Casey says, and I'm the spare, and I'm like, really, you two?
Oh no.
It's just like, oh, that's funny how they sorted
there's
out
something else.
No,
yes.
My god. So thank you. I want to thank all our listeners once again. We've been speaking with the absolutely amazing Tanya Prince from Sickle Cell Houston. And she shared so much with us and hopefully has inspired all of you, as she has me, to get up, show up, and do something.
For more information on the Sickle Cell Association of Houston, please reach us at 832-930-7224 or visit our website at www.sicklecellhouston.org.
Thank you for the torch. Right. Thank you for the torch.
Thank you.
Okay. All right.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, we're just about out of time today, but before we go, I wanted to let you know that you can learn more about our organization on our website, accessadvocacy.org, or on the Access Advocacy Facebook page. That's AXISADVOCAY.org. Join us again next Tuesday on thepowerofvoices.com at noon Pacific, or listen anytime on demand at accessadvocacy.org. You'll find all our programs there. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. Thank you for listening.